Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I have with me a client of mine who I fell in love with when I looked at her collection. And it turns out that the museum, Santa Barbara Museum of Art, emailed me and said, oh, our museum store is having a special event because Mary Tonetti Dora, who we're going to speak to in a few minutes, has written a book, and she's having a book signing at the museum store. And so I said, Mary, I want your book. I want to read your book. And lo and behold, here it is. I Am a Portrait, Flash Fiction and Other Short Stories. And what a cool read. Mary, you know, I finished it in one sitting, and I thought, I really, really would like very much to have more, because each story is very short, a couple of pages, but they're so poignant and really wonderful. I had really enjoyed reading the book, and I think it's gonna what you call grow legs. You know, Mary has just a little introduction. She has a lifetime of adventure. And also, I can attest to this, a love of art. She's lived in Italy, France, and of course, Santa Barbara. And she's been here for a long time. She's written articles for Gourmet.
Latin America.
And Latin America.
Yeah.
Written travel articles for Gourmet Magazine, New York Times, etc. Some of the previous books are Beautiful American Vegetable Gardens, Beautiful American Rose Gardens, Demeter's Choice, A Portrait of My Grandmother as a Young Artist, and Two Lives on Four Continents, a double memoir. And we're going to celebrate for about a half hour now Mary's book signing, which is going to be Saturday, December 14th. And then she's giving a short talk at Mary Craig Auditorium. So the book signing is... Well, first the talk. The talk is from 2 to 2:30, and then the book signing is 2:30 to 4. And Mary, just a couple of questions about the book. So it's really unique because, you know, usually authors write consistently in the third person or the first person, and Mary's book skips between the first person and the third person, firstly. And secondly, there's many... You know, I know that Mary is an accomplished foodie, and there's a lot of the stories in the book involve cooking or food or the enjoyment of food, etc. And then, you know, it's sort of a strange situation for me because I think, oh, is Mary writing about Mary or is Mary writing about a fictional character? In other words, there's one particular...
Is that what you want to know? Who is I Am a Portrait?
Right, exactly. So the title is I Am a Portrait. So who is I Am a Portrait, Mary? You take it from here. Tell me.
That is the work of art itself. And the work of art is a wonderful portrait of a female clown. And the portrait was done by the artist, the Cuban artist. And this is sort of a tribute to our new museum director, Amada Cruz, who is from Cuba. And Porto Carrero is the portrait painter. But the I in I Am a Portrait is the painting itself. And that is one of the paintings in the Dora collection.
Definitely. I remember seeing it. This is a question for you, Mary. When you talk in the book about a grandmother and the sort of inaccessibility and the search for recognition from a grandmother, Does this have anything to do with a portrait of your third book?
What? No. It's not a grandmother. It is the portrait itself. And I refer to the owner at the time, the person who bought the painting in Havana. And that is my mother-in-law.
So I'm talking about the short story called The Search for Approval in your book.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
And I'm talking about the grandmother that you write about in the short story. And I'm wondering if the grandmother is anything like any of your grandmothers.
Yes, she is my maternal grandmother. Thank you for correcting me.
Okay, so that's your maternal grandmother. And she was, I did my new puppy. she was rather difficult to get along with. Is that correct?
Well, she didn't like children. She wasn't difficult. She was very, very smart. She was one of the first women graduates of the University of Michigan. And I didn't think she liked me. And she told us when we were children that we made a lot of work for our mother. And I wanted her approval. And my aunt told me when I was a grown woman, after I'd graduated from Vassar, I was her favorite grandchild. And I was so pleased to hear that. I said, she certainly didn't show that. The audio's not on, Elizabeth.
I guess my question would be the book that you wrote, The Search for Demeter or Demeter, how are you pronounced? That is a book about your grandmother. Which grandmother?
Different grandmother.
Okay.
That's my grandmother. She was very easy to get along with.
Okay. So now, what? This is the question. What is it about your grandmothers that intrigued you?
Well, they were very different women. Both of them, one was very artistic, and that's the one I wrote about as a portrait of my grandmother, my third book. And she was a sculptor, and she had a very wonderful life. They did have money, and she came from an old New York family with governors in the background and all kinds of people, the Lawrences. And she made a name for herself as a sculptor at the time of the World's Fair in Chicago. She did the statue of Columbus. That was, and it was called the Columbian Exposition. That was the Columbian Exhibition was in honor of Christopher Columbus. And my grandmother, Mary Lawrence, after whom I was named, she was the one who did the sculpture of Christopher Columbus at the World's Fair. The other grandmother had a literary society in Santa Barbara, California, and she gathered together young writers, and she and a man named Paul Ellerby, and those were two people who were rather well known at the time, Susan Hyde.
How interesting. So I know that your maiden name is Tinetti, and I know that in the book you mentioned many times your love of Italy, the Italian language, etc. And I know that that was your study in school was Italy, and that you taught at UCSB also. You taught Italian. How was it a family connection that made you fall in love with the language?
I think that's right. I think it must have been that. I know that when I went to Vassar, I studied Italian. I did not know it before. And I studied Italian and lived in Italy for several years. I worked for Time Life in the Rome Bureau, and wrote about art, fashion, and the movies. It was a wonderful job at Time Life. I interviewed all the most important art movie people, like Fellini. I was there at the time of the Dolce Vita, and that was an exciting part of life. And that, I don't know, does that answer your question? I wanted to go to Italy because of my name, and that having that Italian name did have some intriguing connections, because when I was ready to leave after 3 years in Italy, I got a, I think I put this in one of the books, that I got a letter, a registered letter from the Department of Citizenship, Roman Commune, and it was a postcard. And I thought, how curious, they think I'm Italian. And I took the postcard and went, and it said, report immediately to the Department of Citizenship. So I went to the Roman Commune and presented the postcard. And they said, there was something on the postcard that indicated it was important. I didn't know what that was. So I was only about 25 or 26. And I had already made my plans to go back to America. So they kept showing me into one fancier and fancier room at the Roman Commune, saying, through that door, through that door. And then I got into a room that had Titians on the wall and was very, very impressive. And there was an Italian bureaucrat who said, il passaporto. And he said, you're not really an Italian. You're not really an American. We can make you an Italian citizen right away. I was terrified. I thought they'd already tampered my passport. And I really treated it as if it were a sort of amorous proposal. And I said, well, I'm very flattered. Thank you very much. But I have to go back to America, and I am an American. And he said, but you've been very happy here, haven't you? And I said, of course I have in Italy. And I said, but c'è la mamma, it's my mother. I have to go back and take care of her. So that was, he said, oh, I understand. Oh, capito. So that was how I got out of that situation, thinking very quickly. I knew he would understand if my mother needed me.
So why do you think he wanted you to become an Italian citizen?
They wanted me to be a spy.
Oh,
the American.
Oh, I get it. Okay. Oh, how exciting, Mary. what a life. Another question I have for you in the short story about the golden cups, the golden coffee cups. Did something similar, first of all, my first question, did something similar happen to you and Henry?
No, that was all fiction.
Okay. And what about meeting Italo Calvino?
Yeah, Italo Calvino. I never met him. I just admired him as a writer.
Okay. And so that worked itself into the story. I love it. I love his books as well. And I thought, it has Mary. And what about Berenson? Did you meet him?
No, I had to leave Italy before I could meet him. And so I never did. I moved to Venice.
I see. So now this is a couple of questions about the craft of writing, because this is it your fourth book? I'm a Portrait? Fifth book. Okay. So when do you write?
Well, I get ideas in the middle of the night, and they're not, sometimes they're complete stories. Those three that where the narrators are the works of art, those came to me almost as complete stories. But if I remember the stories, then I write them down when I wake up in the morning. And otherwise, I try to work in the morning. I do
and
have
so,
some,
go ahead.
Some responsibilities here at Val Verde, I'm in charge of life enrichment. And so I have to bring speakers. I take 20 people to a different restaurant every month, and I seat them at little tables so they can talk to each other, four at a table. And that's been a lot of fun for me.
All right. So I have to ask, what's your favorite restaurant in town?
Well, I have several, but I like very much Stella Mare, and I like, I like the one that is owned by a Santa Barbara woman. I'm so sorry. I can't remember it right now.
That's all right. And so this passion for food, who was, you know, and there's a short story too in the book about a chef. So, yes. So who in your life turned you on to cooking?
Oh, I think I was born with it. It's called atavism. Yes, there were several cooks in my family. The one that I wrote about, Mickey, he's my cousin, and he was a very good cook. His name was Joe Hyde, H-Y-D-E. And he wrote a beautiful little book called Love, Thyme, and Butter, E-I-M-E. And then my grandmother Tenet was a very, very good cook. And she did a lot of Italian things because her husband, and French, because her husband was French with an Italian name.
So this is a question that I have to ask because I had a long stint working for the Dallas Theater Center. So I lived in Texas for a while. And I didn't think of Dallas, especially, or Fort Worth, as at the time full of culture.
Oh, yeah. And I did not.
Go ahead. Tell me more.
Well, I was my mother and father had artist parents, and both of them. And so art was very important to my mother and the performing art. I was a dancer. I danced in the Fort Worth Civic Opera and a corps de ballet. I wasn't very good, so I didn't continue that, but I did choreography when I was at Vassar, and I was trained by very good dancers. Merce Cunningham and Jose Limon came from New York to Poughkeepsie to teach us. And that was an exciting time. But the food, I mean, that wasn't a particularly important thing in my Texas life. My mother tried to make it possible for me to go to every performing arts situation I could get myself into. And so, in Fort Worth, and then when I went to school in Dallas, I had tickets to the Margot Jones Theater in the Round and everything that was culturally available, I went to.
And what did your family do? What line of work was your dad and mom in Dallas? In Fort Worth?
Well, my father said when he graduated from Princeton, I've had enough of the artistic life with my two parents, sculptors. I want to be a businessman. And my grandmother, Tenetti, knew a lot of people in New York, and she got him connected with her friend, who was the head of the General Portland Cement Company in Chicago. And before he knew it, he had a job with the Trinity Cement, which was a branch of the General Portland Cement Company, and he was a very good salesman. My father was not an intellectual. He was not an artist, but he was a very attractive man and a good salesman. And so he sold cement to all the lumber companies in Texas and Fort Worth and Dallas and all around, and he loved that. He loved meeting those men. And so he made enough money to be able to raise four children and go to Martha's Vineyard every summer. And, and he took us all there in Massachusetts. And we had it was not a fancy place where we lived, but it was a very nice little cabin with no running water, no electricity. We had kerosene lamps. We had to go swimming because there was no running water. We had to go swimming every morning before breakfast. That was a rule from my father. And we went fishing and we went clamming and we had a wonderful life. And I read a lot. So I wasn't working all the time, but I did have a job later in Martha's Vineyard. But it was my father was a businessman.
So that figures into your book too. I Am a Portrait. There is a section on, is it the vineyard or the Cape, where a similar house is described—a little cabin with no running water—and it was, sort of the kids loved it, but it was a real primitive little place. And just think about it now.
That's not where the portrait was. The portrait was with my daughter, Helen, Dr. Helen Dora, because she loved that portrait. It was her companion when she was a child in Paris, in our family.
Ah, well, I was thinking about the story. I don't know which story it was in, but the fact that you work into this story, that there are children that visit the Cape or the vineyard every year, and they stay in a very primitive cabin. And that was when you were talking about your dad bringing you all to the cabin. That's what I was thinking of. Richard's giving us a sign, Mary. We got to go to quick break. And I want to just do another quick shout out, Richard, because we're at the half hour, we have another interview coming in. And I want to just thank Mary Tinetti Dora for a wonderful little book. And it's called I Am a Portrait. And I really, really enjoyed it, Mary. I thought it was just And you write in a very lyrical way. I just was hungry for more when I was finished with it. It's too short for me. I wanted more, but I imagine that's forthcoming. Saturday, December 14th, the book signing reception, and there will be a talk from 2 to 2:30 at the Mary Craig Auditorium. And then the book signing is actually at the museum store at 2:30 to 4. And you can pick up an autographed copy of I Am a Portrait, Flash Fiction, and Other Short Stories. And Mary, thank you very much for coming on and speaking to us. I was really, really, I'm serious when I say, when I finished, I was like, oh, damn, I want more. So you've got to write a follow-up.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being with you today and with Richard. Bye, Richard.
Okay, go to a quick break. When we get back from the break, we have another interview. Alex Lucas is coming on. Don't turn that dial. Back in a minute.
You are clear, and good to see you again.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart, and I have a really deep pleasure in introducing Alex Lucas to the show. Alex is a professor at UCSB, and how I got to know Alex was he was doing an event that was based on the graphics in printmaking, but graphics as a vehicle for visual expression. And I thought, not only is that philosophically rich, but it's something that I personally love because I love the written word and I also love the visual world and couldn't live without either. And Alex is doing a show that will be opening at UCSB at the Art, Design, and Architecture Museum. It's going to be called Public Texts, A Californian Visual Language. And I think this is so important in today's world. The exhibition is going to examine the unique and surprising way California artists utilize text. And like I said, it's curated by Alex Lucas, Associate Professor of Print and Publication. The exhibition opens Saturday, January 18th. The public reception is 5:30 to 7:30, remaining on view till April of 2025. And I find it interesting, Alex, that you focus on California artists. Obviously, you know, it's appropriate. I mean, it is UCSB. It is the Art and Architecture Design Museum, University of California, Santa Barbara, et cetera. But iconically speaking, you know, the written word has been so important in California art. When we talk about recognition of even a place, placehood, you know, it flashes into the mind that big Hollywood sign that you capitalize on.
Yes.
In your show. So what got you thinking about this? And I really would like to know what your relationship is with the written word as a visual artist. And then maybe I'd like to have you talk a little bit about some of the works that you've done as an artist. I'm thinking of one in particular that was done in Granite City, Illinois. And in one piece displayed at Standard, Blue Tarp and Cellular Telephone Network, et cetera, et cetera. That intrigued me greatly. And so let's start by talking about why you pulled the show together. What was the philosophy behind the show? Why is the written word so important to you as a visual artist?
Sure. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for having me on the show. And I'm really excited to talk about this subject because, as you've sort of eloquently expressed, the relationship between the written word and sort of visual artistic practices feels at once rich, but also contradictory. And those different ways that we think about seeing something versus reading something. And this is a subject I discuss with my students in our foundation's two-dimensional design class. But every year I tell them to, you know, get ready, and I'm going to put a slide up on the screen and just shout out the color that you see and pause for a second, move to the next slide. And it's the word red written in bright blue. And half the students scream out red because that's what they're reading. Half the students scream out blue because that's what they're seeing. And so there's a discrepancy there that I think is really fun. And the way that artists have played with that and challenged which act we're engaging in, reading or seeing, is sort of the core of this exhibition. The piece you described, the blue tarp, was for a alternative exhibition space just outside of St. Louis that an artist, Sage Dawson, curates. And it's a flagpole by a bus stop in this sort of post-industrial area of town, from what I understand it. And so I think of the blue tarp as a sort of ubiquitous mechanism for blocking. It's something we see to sort of cover holes, to keep people's prying eyes out of our yards. So for this work, I put my cell phone number in the blue tarp and had it hang as a flag for 3 months in outside of St. Louis, and just kind of encouraged people to call me. It was my actual cell phone number, and it's still up on my website. And so that way that we can think of text as a tool for connecting, and public art especially as a way to facilitate surprising connections. That was the focus of that piece that you're describing.
So, Alex, a couple of things there, just reacting to the blue tarp issue. So, and then how this kind of came together in my mind. So I was in the Peace Corps 2 or 3 years in Africa, and people use those tarps as habitation. Mm. They live in the tarps. And so it's, you know, ubiquitous all over Well, we were in Apapa, which is outside of Lagos, and I can remember the seas, oceans of blue tarps. And that's first thing that flashed in my mind when you were talking about keeping prying eyes out. That also keeps something within the tarps. Yeah. And then the second thing, I don't know how this flashed on me as you were talking, I was thinking about space and the word in visual context. So I was thinking about all those little things that people that ran businesses put on the floor during the pandemic, 6 feet, and the graphic representation of space with that 6 feet. That flashed on me as you were talking about your interest in public and visual and word and, I mean, and space, basically. So I was like on four levels thinking of it.
And I think you're articulating a lot of the things that I'm really curious about how language in space helps direct us, helps locate our bodies, helps sort of, helps is maybe the generous term, but also sort of directs and potentially inhibits how we move through the world, which is really then, you know, to the focus of this exhibition, looking at how artists take and respond to, specifically in California, these sort of vernacular languages, be that signage, graffiti,
right,
road markings, all of these different activist posters, these different ways that texts are employed to call us to action, to think about how we view and react to the world around us.
And I mean, Richard Dugan, our producer, he's often joked with me because, you know, I inhabit a visual world, but he's also joking with me about how many visual images are up there. And he points up there, what he means is in the cloud. And, you know, there's billions and billions. And so I guess the profundity or the rarity of a visual work of art is sorely diminished in our age because there's so much visual impact everywhere. And I wondered what you thought about that. And what comes to mind is it Heidegger? What is a thing? And he's actually writing about thingness versus words. And this happens to be something that I think about, Alex, because, you know, I'm an appraiser, so I'm in the valuation world, but I'm also in the world of symbols and what these objects hold for the owners. So it's so we have a similar kind of philosophy, I believe, at least from what I was reading about you over the past week as I was getting ready to talk with you. I want to know one thing when we get back from the break. Richard's giving us a sign we have to go to quick break. So, you know, you teach and it was an amazing thing when you had the show at the Civic Arts Workshop. When you had the show there, I was flabbergasted by the amount of people that came and all of the people that came to all of the lectures that you had organized. I myself attended two or three, and I thought, my gosh, what a magnificent turnout for something that I considered kind of a scholarly, almost, you know, kind of hard to digest, you know, and yet it was just overwhelmingly crowded. And this was really heartening for me. I thought, wow, there's hope for. And that, I guess what I want to ask you when we get back from the break is, how do you recognize talent?
Ooh.
Right? How do you recognize talent? Yeah. And that's what I was kind of thinking, because I'll just give you, you'll know the artist that I was going to refer to. So I was asked by the San Diego Museum of Art to interview an artist that they were actually, it was the Contemporary Museum, that they were actually thinking of buying. And I went to interview this artist and I said, you know, can you give me a quick description because I'm going to the women's board, who's in charge of buying a work for the museum. I'm going back and reporting, you know, what you say to me, visual imagery that you let me shoot. And then also I want to know some of your valuation records, what you sell things for and how you sell them, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, look, if I wanted to talk and do numbers, I would not be a visual artist.
Fair.
You know, and I thought, well, that's so different, because I was looking at the crowds, you know, really following the cross-cultural or cultural aspect of what you were bringing together, thinking, well, this guy, you know, he was kind of maybe from another generation, maybe. Anyway, Richard, let's go to quick break. And when we get back from the break, hey, Richard, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to know, Alex, as a professor, philosopher, artist, how he recognizes talent. Big question. Don't turn that dial. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. Great honor of speaking with Professor Alex Lucas, who's mounting a show, which is going to be fantastic. Public Texts, A California Visual Language. And the mind just boggles when you think about all of the signs that we look at. And there's, in semiotics, there's a real division between symbol and sign. And that kind of got me thinking about what the difference was between symbol and sign. And then I want to ask Alex what his opinion is. But before I do that, I want to know, as a teacher, artist, and scholar, how do you recognize talent in your students, Alex?
Well, you know, I think there's been a lot of discussions recently about how we even, and this, I apologize if this sounds like a dodge, but how we even define talent. And what we might think of then as how different artworks can speak to different audiences, and how, you know, talent derives from all of these backgrounds that we bring from our lived experience to making artwork. So something that for me is really exciting about this exhibition is thinking about how all of the artists have a relationship with California, whether they were born here, whether they reside here now, whether they studied here, and how that experience of living and working in this space has influenced their work and influenced the aesthetics they're responding to, the conceptual conceits that they're dealing with, the background that they bring to making. So talent, then, we might think of as less a sort of binary, you have it or you don't, but how it's sort of how you reflect what you are interested in to an audience, if that makes sense.
So I also want to know that, so it does make sense. It makes perfect sense, because, you know, what we're looking for is a certain, as you say, making, not necessarily making in a sort of already society defined way, as, you know, you say, oh, that looks like a fill in the artist's name. Right.
Exactly. And that, you know, that the exhibition starts with a print from John Baldessari and a print from Ed Ruscha and two prints from Carita Kent, these sort of really important artists working in the late 60s, early 70s with text, and how especially somebody like Ruscha was pulling from commercial signage, was really playing with this notion of pop culture references, but with a distinct sort of West Coast flavor. And for me, the conceptualization of this show started with thinking about how that generation of West Coast artists were playing with text in a sort of very different realm than maybe their East Coast contemporaries working a little bit later, like Jenny Holzer or Lawrence Wiener, who played with this sort of deadpan sans serif font, while, you know, Kent and Ruscha and Baldessari are playing with similar, maybe conceptual concerns, but with a visual lyricism that really energized the work and transformed language from just something you read into a sort of visual motif that I think the other artists in the show, sort of the artists creating since, some are responding to, some are building off of, some are rejecting, but all playing with that act of reading. And it feels extra important to explore that today. And Elizabeth, something you said before sort of got this sparked in my mind, but it feels like a reading more than ever, maybe with less attention span, but thinking about, you know, not only all the signage around us, but our phones, our social media feeds. It feels like we are encountering language and text at a volume that, if not unprecedented, is certainly increased over the past couple of years.
So what you're making me think of is spell check, which is insulting and a fact of life. And it kind of takes away one's expertise in language because you rely on it so much. And I was thinking about that as a public kind of display. You know, it's like a spell check, and it's, you know, I have so many text messages where it's obviously spell check has been, you know, the demon in the machine. And then, you know, then the sender will say, I hate spell check. And I have a whole feed with I hate spell check. And I was thinking about that in terms of your idea of public versus private. And, you know, you are bringing the public sphere into a very gallery setting at the museum. Can you reflect on that for me?
Sure. And I think about there's one work in the exhibition, one of the two Carita Kent prints that is a image of a crosswalk with slow written. And it's sort of based off a photograph I'm assuming the artist took or referenced of, you know, slow down as you approach the crosswalk. And, you know, I've been looking at this image for years. And it was only once we got the loan document from the Carita Art Center, who's loaning us the work, put that into the document that I'm compiling for the wall labels in the museum, and it underlined in red. And the I'm copy and pasting, so I know that this typo is intentional. And I look back at the original work, and it is, in fact, the typo is very intentionally put into the piece. It isn't slow, S-L-O-W, it's S-O-L-W. And that way that our eyes gloss over typos and sort of allow us to read, you know, efficiently, something that for me, the whole exhibition is focused on is the act of slowing down. And how we might think about reading and looking as things, as acts that we really should be spending more time with. And the visualization of language encourages us, so it almost mandates that we take the time to really look with intention. You know, there's a famous statistic that I'm somewhat skeptical of, that the average museum goer looks at a work of art for 10 seconds. And that's sort of all, you know, the Mona Lisa, you go, it's 10 seconds. That's all the time you give it. Language then introduced into that space mandates us reading and spending just a little bit more time with the work that is the challenge I ask all my students to think about with their practice. How do we ask our viewer to really spend time and engage with the works that we're making?
I think that's amazing, that beautifully put. And it's really interesting to me. Carita Kent is a great poster child for this, I guess you could say, you know, an activist woman of faith. And I noticed that her works now are, I guess in the last 5 years, they've leapt in value. So, I mean, really, she's become quite an important artist and not just a propagandist. You know, Richard, are you saying we have to go? Oh, we're just getting started. Hey, Alex, I look forward to the show. Now, just one more shout out about the show. This is opening January 18th at the Art, Design, and Architecture Museum at UCSB, curated by Alex Lucas. The show is entitled Public Text, a California Visual Language. Can't wait. Alex, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.